Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Clean Tech podcast. Each week, our host David Hunt speaks to a leading startup CEO, executive, or thought leader in the clean tech sector. Focused on the clean energy and clean mobility transitions, each guest shares the highs and lows of their clean tech journey, their industry insights, and their vision and hopes for the future.
Hello, I'm David Hunt, CEO and founder of Hyperion Executive Search and your host for the Leaders in Clean Tech podcast. Thank you to everyone who provided feedback on the last episode with Gretchen Bucker. It was something a little different, but seemed to go down very well. Please do keep your feedback coming. It's really useful, and as it seems, it's all pretty positive. If you can rate us or write a review on Apple Podcasts or your platform of choice, that would be much appreciated. This week, we return to the US and to an innovative flow battery company I've been watching for a while as I speak with Craig Evans. Craig is the president and CEO and the founder of ESS Inc. Having started ESS from his garage back in 2011, he led the company to the commercialization of the iron flow battery system in 2016. Craig has authored over 15 patents and patent applications. He holds a BS in aerospace engineering and an MS in mechanical engineering from Clarkson University, and an MS in finance from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and an MBA from Carnegie Mellon University. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Clean Tech podcast, Craig. It's great to have you join me. How are things in Portland right now?
Oh, they're good. It's not raining, so the spring is starting to get here, so we're losing the rainy weather, which is always good.
Yeah, I think everybody more than ever this year is looking forward to some spring sunshine.
Absolutely.
Cool. So listen, I'm really glad that you're able to join us. And given your experiences in aviation, fuel cells, flow batteries, and a broad range of technologies, I'm really keen to get some of your thoughts on the energy transition broadly, as well as the ESS product. And that's it's quite timely, of course, after the recent episode where we focused on some of the fundamental flaws and issues with the US electricity grid that were particularly exposed in Texas recently and California last year. So to see how ESS are playing your part in improving that. But it's customary for the podcast that we start off with a little bit of your backstory, if you would. So can you perhaps share a little bit of your journey, more specifically how you came to found ESS back in 2011?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, my career started off in aviation. I worked at Pratt Whitney, working on gas turbines back in the early days when I got out of school. But I always was really interested in renewable energy. Back in college, was running the solar car days, so working on PV and doing some transportation with solar cars, and so I was always interested in that. So I got into Pratt Whitney, but my real drive was to try to get into UTC fuel cells. Which was part of the United Technology conglomerate there. So Pratt Whitney, UTC Power, OnSite, Carrier, so on and so forth. So I was really trying to get into UTC fuel cells. And my end was through Pratt Whitney because I have an aerospace engineering degree. And I worked for Pratt Whitney for about a year and a half, and then I finally was able to find a way to get into UTC fuel cells. And that was great. I mean, I learned a ton about electric chemistry with the team at UTC Fuel Cells. Started off in the test group, was a grunt doing a lot of testing work for the small-scale fuel cells and then ultimately the automotive stuff. They still had their NASA unit down in Windsor, Connecticut, so I got to see the stuff that was being used for NASA and was used in the Apollo days, so that was really fascinating. And then from there, I worked at probably UTC Power or Fuel Cells, whatever it was. They changed their name a couple times. But eventually, I think 10 years in, I got recruited to a startup called Clear Edge Power, which was out here in Hillsboro, Oregon. Yeah. And it was a small startup. There was probably, I think, 10 people at the company at the time. One of the CTO at UTC, yes, sorry, the CTO at Clear Edge Power was an old friend from UTC, so he recruited me in, and I led the engineering and product development group there. And so there we were developing residential scale combined heat and power fuel cells. Basically, you take natural gas in, you reform it, make high quality hydrogen gas. That goes into the fuel cell, and whatever's not used, typically the remainder of 20% or so, would get pushed back into the steam reformer. And they basically keep that loop going. And that was, You know, the goal there was to have 90% total efficiency, about 40% electrical, 90% total. That was a very challenging project. I mean, it was the size of a refrigerator, and the goal was to put it in California to minimize base load use. So that was a learned a lot there. You really used every little bit of your engineering expertise to get that project off the ground.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in I think 2010 is when I started to see renewables really start to take off. You started to see wind and solar prices really coming down. We were getting very frustrated with the cost of fuel cells and the challenges with bringing those costs down.
Right.
At the time, the VP of Research and Development, Dr. Julia Song at ClearEdge, you know, we started talking, and I kind of convinced her that, you know, potentially batteries were the next best thing. And in 2011, I left ClearEdge Power to start ESS. I started in my garage. Julie and I had been working on it in the evening times. Had a vanadium flow battery up and running in the garage, and was getting chemicals sent to my address. Until one day, the DEA basically put a stop to that, because apparently you can't get lots of chemicals sent to a residential address. So we tried a bunch of different ways to overcome that. We got a UPS virtual mailbox that eventually got shut down by the VWR, who's the shipping manufacturer of the chemicals.
Right.
And then, you know, eventually that forced us to have to go in an office. And so really in 2011 is when we moved into our first office, and that's when Julia joined the company full time. And so if, for those who don't know, Julia is also my wife, and so we got married, who's now, Julia is also the CTO of ESS here.
Okay.
So that always adds an interesting wrinkle to everything.
She's great. Sure.
Extremely smart electrochemist. She's probably one of the reasons why we're as successful today as we are.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's an extra dynamic to the process. I always love the founder stories, and they're so wide and varied. And I guess it's kind of nice to have the archetypal stud in the garage thing, but you don't think about those simple processes of just getting stuff sent to you being potentially a problem.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Cool. So I've been watching ESS for some years, and I think I mentioned I met some of the team down in San Diego at Energy Storage North America in 2019 when we could still travel around. And that must have been, I think, just after your C round of fundraising, as I understand it. And one of the things, as the audience will know, at Hyperion, we work with a lot of clients in lithium-ion space and across the battery piece, and that's all pretty cool. But personally, I really love the long-duration storage piece, because I see it as a really important part for us to get through the transition, or get to the sort of energy transition that we have. So I'd love to see companies like yours evolve. Can you tell me a little bit, though, specifically about the ESS technology and why you chose to use iron ore rather than vanadium, which we've touched on, or other electrolytes or other solutions? Can you share a little bit about your particular technology and its advantages?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, Julie and I initially started off with vanadium as the chemistry that we thought we were going to go with. And the reason is because, you know, the chemistry is relatively well known. And what Julie and I really had our experience in was building the battery modules, or the flow modules. We had a lot of experience in building fuel cells, both at UTC as well as at ClearEdge. And so we thought we could bring something unique to the flow battery space. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, our goal was really to increase the ability for the battery to output 10x more power than any of the other competitors. And we were going to drive down cost by doing so, by just driving down the cost of the actual hardware. The challenge is with vanadium, the cost of the electrolyte alone was more than the ultimate targets for energy storage. And so, you know, within a year, we quickly abandoned that chemistry and went to the iron-based chemistry. You know, now we didn't invent the iron-based chemistry, though I give full credit to Dr. Savinel at Case Western for doing that in the early 80s. They did some of the early work on this, but I think they ran into some challenges early on where they weren't able to cycle the battery and maintain the performance for more than maybe a handful of cycles.
All right.
But what Julie and I were able to do is we were able to overcome those issues. It took us about 6 months or so. We used the same exact battery module we were using than we were using for the vanadium, minus the negative side. The positive side, the electrode stayed relatively similar, but we changed the negative side because on our chemistry, counter to a vanadium, in a vanadium you have both redox reactions on both the positive and the negative.
Yep.
In our chemistry, we really have the Fe2 plus, the Fe3 plus, the ferrous, the ferric reaction on the positive. But on the negative side, we actually have a plating reaction. So we're taking ferrous And we're actually electroplating that on a carbon surface. And so that was different, and the challenges overcoming, the challenges you have to overcome with electroplating iron was one of the main things. And the main challenge with our chemistry, is, no battery's perfect, right? So even lithium ion has efficiency issues. Yeah. And cycle over cycle, batteries get out of balance, and that's a lot of cases where you run into your capacity fade or your performance problems. And our battery is no different, right? So for our case, the biggest challenge is pH imbalance from the positive side to the negative side. Other batteries have state of charge imbalance, and we have that as well, but we have some interesting ways to take care of that. But the main challenge with our batteries, if you look at the Pore-Betty diagram for iron, ferric, which is the Fe3 plus state, which is our charge state on the positive side, does not like high pH. It'll precipitate out into basically rust.
Right.
And on the negative side, the battery wants to be at as low pH as possible to prevent as many side reactions. I'm sorry, to be as high pH as possible to prevent as side reactions. And our side reaction, because we're in a water solution, is going to be hydrogen on the negative side. And so we're trying to minimize that because that's going to impact efficiency. And you have a relatively pure reaction on the positive side, so every electron that is transferred on the positive side is going to be put to useful work, but that electron on the negative side, a part of it is going to go to hydrogen generation, and the other part is going to go to electroplating iron.
Right.
And so you're going to have this state of charge imbalance, and you're also going to have this pH imbalance that's occurring. And so what happens is you're charging the protons, are streaming over the negative side, they're driving down the pH, which is going to cause you to evolve hydrogen on the negative side. It's also going to charge you to get out of imbalance on the positive side. And so what we do is we have a proton pump. Julia likes to explain it as it's kind of like the kidney for the battery, in that the proton pump keeps our electrolyte clean, in that
right.
It takes any hydrogen that is evolved, it basically converts it back to a proton and puts it on the positive side. And when we put that proton back at the positive side, we actually convert the ferric back to ferrous. So we're actually putting the state of charge back into balance. And we're also putting that proton back on the positive side, which keeps the pH low on the positive side and keeps the pH high on the negative side.
Yeah, really, really interesting work. And I think that's, again, I think one of the challenges. I started working with people like Red Tea and other flow battery companies, again, many years ago. And I figured or felt that it was a technology that should have its place relatively quickly. And I think a combination of some of those technical issues you talked about and also just the amount of money and interest that the lithium-ion battery space has sucked up, and of course done phenomenally well with, let's not forget, it has an amazing cost reduction and energy density improvements. But how have you, I guess, coped, because you talk about commercializing in 2016, in that backdrop of both the technical challenges you kind of touched on there, but also the fact that the market has changed so quickly and some of those competitive technologies have changed so quickly?
Yeah, so I mean, when we started the company back in 2011, long duration storage was an hour, right? And so people were telling us that we were crazy that we were building an 8-hour battery or a 12-hour battery. So it was tough to get traction in the early days. But in the grand scheme of things, the technology development is relatively easy. I think we had, on a lab scale, we had everything working pretty good probably within the first year when we transitioned to the iron-based chemistry. We had the proton pump working pretty good. The battery was cycling tens of thousands of cycles without any issues in the lab. The challenge really comes around scale up. And so I'm always fascinated when the press takes hold of a new technology out of the lab and they say it's going to be the next big thing, because we've spent the fair majority of our evolution as an organization scaling up correctly. And it's just not scaling up internally, but it's also scaling your customers and it's scaling your vendors, right? So it's a lot of thought leadership, getting people to understand how the technology works, how they can gain additional revenue with the technology. It's getting your vendors up to speed that, you are a small company, but you are going to have a scale long term. You need a quality product. Please don't ship me parts that are contaminated, because it's only going to slow me down. And then, how do you actually grow the organization internally? People tend to be problematic sometimes, and so how do you build a cohesive team that's going to work together and scale the organization?
Now, just on an interesting point there, I was going to ask about that, because obviously founding the business in 2011, which in clean tech years, they're a bit like dog years, I guess. They seem to be an awful lot longer than most, so it's a long time ago in this sector. You've touched on a few there, but I was keen to see what the challenges were in those early years particularly, and how they've evolved, and what the biggest challenges that you face now are, I guess, more so on a personal level as much as on a company level.
Yeah, so I would say we deployed our first product to Stone Edge Farms up in Northern California, which is a vineyard. And we did that, our first real money into the organization was a grant from ARPA-E. And that was like a $2.1 million grant, which really is what catalyzed the organization. Without that grant, I don't think we would have been here today. So we're extremely grateful for the ARPA-E folks. And so the culmination of that project at ARPA-E was to build a 10 kilowatt battery and to scale it up. And so we did that at our little incubator facility in downtown Portland, and shipped that to Stone Edge Farms. And I think, you know, the majority of the challenges we had, I would say, the first one is going to be with shipping and handling. While the battery probably worked just fine at our facility, shipping and handling always create weird effects. You know, we did a lot of vibrational studies on site at our facility, but then once you actually ship it, you don't realize what the actual shippers put that product through to get the site. So we had cracked pipes and so on and so forth that we needed to replace. So I would say that was our big challenge for the first system there. As we evolved and we moved into the energy warehouse, which is our standardized product today. We shipped the first one to UC San Diego, which was one of our first customers for the EW. We still had shipping problems with that one, but I think the big problem with that one is we had a lot of contamination from our vendors as we deploy that system. It's always great to get material from Alpha Azer running 99.99% material quality, but as you try to drive down cost and get material that's more commoditized as opposed to lab-grade material, you know, you never know what you're really going to get. People may say you're going to get this high-quality material, but then it actually comes in and there's a ham sandwich in it as well, which you weren't anticipating. Or, you know, you're trying to scale, so instead of using U.S. vendors, you try to go to China and use Chinese vendors. And while you're using the same resins to do your compression moldings in the States as you would in China, you may not be using the exact same resin that you think when you go to China, or they're not following the exact same recipes. And so unless you have on-site quality in your international vendors, it's always hard to understand what you're going to get. And so we had a lot of leaching into the chemistry. And anytime you're running really an aqueous-based chemistry, you know, you can get leaching, which is going to cause problems long-term for a battery, any electrochemical device.
And I think that's an interesting point, because that's one of the real challenges, I think, in any of these technologies or companies. And there's the technical, as we touched on, the sort of technical challenges of accurating the product, and also then, as you touched on there, scaling the product and how do you get it bigger and reduce the costs, all these kind of things you've just touched on. And then of course it's scaling the business, where, you know, from a couple of people to however many people you are now, that those kind of challenges. Have they evolved? Because clearly now you've got, it sounds like, you know, most of those travel and sort of early scale problems out of the way, but what are the things that are challenging you now as the business is evolving?
So in terms of headcount, I would say we've had to evolve over the years. And so in the early days, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. So we were always looking to get folks out of school. And so, you know, Julie and I were being the technical leads as well as the business leads, and we were hiring a lot of new grads right out of the university here, either in Oregon or California and Washington, trying to keep it local because we didn't have money to pay for either recruiters or to pay to get people moved up. So, you know, we get a lot of folks right out of school in the early days. But as we progressed and you need to start doing sales and you need to have some gray hairs in the field, you know, we've had to take some risks. Julie and I took probably about, you know, 5 years or so with no salary as we've grown ESS. And so we'd sacrifice our salary to bring in some folks that had some experience to help with sales, start catalyzing things. I think where we're at probably from 2018, 2017 on, is really trying to move away from getting the folks right out of school to getting the more experienced people to bring more credibility to the organization. It's just not Julie and I anymore. We're bringing folks from GE, from Mitsubishi, Hitachi Power, Flare, you know, bringing folks in from the utilities. So Amir, who's our CFO, comes out of SDG&E. Building, I would say, building the management team and building the folks underneath the management team has started to get more and more important. And I would say also as we built the board, board of directors, that's also, I think, been an extremely important aspect of the development of the organization. In the early days, we had a lot of board members that came on from just the investors. But as we built up the organization through bringing on more and more independents, you know, how can you strengthen the board and the expertise on the board by bringing in folks with utility experience?
Yeah.
Or how can you bring folks in from industry that have done something similar? So, you know, we have two board members from First Solar. We kind of equate ourselves to the First Solar journey, where they were a disruptive technology that wasn't necessarily the same as silicon, but they had a lot of extra benefits. And so how do they scale that organization? So, you know, we have Rich and Rafi from First Solar, who's come onto the board and have been instrumental in shaping the organization with their experience from First Solar. But I think where we're at now, you know, we're really trying to bring additional executive staff on to help strengthen the management team, to put more focus on customer service as we deploy more and more product around the world, more thought leadership. Lithium ion is certainly the incumbent out there, but you know, when you get the longer duration storage, you gotta, you're looking and you're gonna put mass amounts of duration. You wanna get a product out in the field that's gonna be clean. It's going to have a low impact, cradle to grave, on the evolution of the product in the field, and it's going to be safe, right?
Yeah.
One of our, you know, California has issued wildfires on the West Coast, and there's mandates in California now where you can't site lithium ion in some places, or you can't site diesel gensets.
Yeah.
Currently, we're the only technology that can be sited in any of those wildfire resiliency zones.
Yeah.
So we'll have product actually going out later this year to demonstrate our ability to operate in a fire resiliency zone and keep those communities and those first responders having the lights on.
Yeah, which is incredibly important, of course. So yeah, it's really interesting, again, you pick on the point there. I mean, it is tough when you're bootstrapping and when you're growing a business to bring in the experience you need. And I think an interesting point you referred to as the gray hairs of having them both as employees. But I think a lot of people underestimate the importance, or at least the benefit, of having the right sort of advisors in and working sort of with you in your organization. And again, not always the obvious place to pick them, but people who've been through similar journeys, even if it's not the same tech. I think sometimes people reach out too much for people who've just got the same sort of too much similar to yourself. But I think those gray hairs, you've had journeys that are similar, but not necessarily always the same challenges, can be really beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, First Solar, I think, went through a very similar trial and tribulations that we did, and just the challenges with scale up, they can bring a tremendous amount of knowledge to the organization and how they got to market, how they scale their organization, how they got their manufacturing up online. That's been great.
Hugely beneficial. Cool. So listen, when you started the business 10 years ago, the energy world looked very, very different than it does now. I started in cleantech 2007, and it's brilliant to look back, but back then we didn't see how things would be now, of course. So there's so much more renewable energy penetration than there was, although to some extent we all saw that coming. But of course, some of those extreme climate and weather events you've touched on, the wildfires in California, and of course the issues in Texas more recently, these cause huge challenges, of course, but also huge opportunities. So how do you see the ESS and perhaps the broader long duration energy storage sector meeting some of these challenges and the opportunities in the next 4 or 5 years?
Yes, you know, when we started the company back in the early days, I mean, I think we saw renewables being put on the grid. We saw the decarbonization efforts. We saw things becoming more decentralized as you brought more renewables online. And you could certainly see the challenges with lithium ion and the potential safety issues that you may have with large amounts of lithium ion in a centralized location. Lithium ion's great. You know, we will never try to disparage lithium ion whatsoever. They have their place in high power applications. But for long duration, as you see more decarbonization, more renewables putting on the grid, you start to see issues where baseload generation is getting stressed because those renewables during the day are really pushing the base loads down, so they have to either throttle down or shut off entirely, which they can't do, so you see curtailment on the low-cost renewables. You see the high ramp rates in the morning and the evenings. I'm trying not to say duck curve, but that's one of the issues we see in California and what's really driving a lot of this stuff, and really some of the early adopter type stuff with long duration, where you really need to start storing that energy that you're getting during the day, which could be 6 or 8 hours in some locations, and being able to use that in the evening times and use it in the morning times to offset some of those ramps that you see. And you know, you can't do that necessarily with lithium ion. You can't store that large amounts of energy, and you can't displace it over a long period of time at cost, which we can. So, you know, if you look at our technology, you know, our cost is at par with lithium ion, but on a levelized cost of storage basis, we are 50% cheaper than that of lithium ion, just because our technology has no capacity fade. Right. We can cycle our technology 20, 25,000 cycles, and you still have a brand new battery. You don't. If you had a 400 kilowatt hour battery or 1 megawatt hour battery on day one, you'll still have a 1 megawatt hour battery in year 20, which means the revenue opportunity you'll have in the field as an operator will be the same on day one as is in year 20. And so that really allows some flexibility to the customers and how they're going to use this battery and keep their grids up and operational and in a safe manner.
Yeah. I think, again, one thing that often comes up when we're speaking to organizations in the longer duration space is that we all know that as we get, you know, hopefully get towards a point of 100% renewables, that so much long duration and even interseasonal storage is going to be required. But right now, it's not necessarily easy to get the revenue stack sufficient in terms of what's the need for 6 to 8 to 12 to 16 sort of hours. Are those some challenges you're facing in any particular states and or in your markets where the product is robust and the solution works, but it's just trying to get the revenues right?
So I would say in 2017, I would think a lot of those issues went away. I think 2017 was really the tipping point for us and the inflection when a lot of the thought leadership we did in the early days and just the market itself really started to take a turn with low-cost renewables. And so, you know, since then, you know, we're starting to see more and more RFPs in the market for longer duration, 6, 8, 10 hours. Those are becoming more and more standard. You're starting to see the IRPs from the utilities looking 10, 20 years out, getting ready for, you know, the mass amounts of renewables are going to be put on the grid. You know, California is looking at 60% renewable penetration by 2030. New York, 70% renewable penetration by 2030. And so, you know, it's not a matter of if, but when, right? And so the problem, I think we're seeing it today in California. They've already got, you know, 25 or some odd percent, close to 30% renewable penetration. They have problems with the grid during the daytime. And so, you know, long duration storage is required today, and, you know, it's only a matter of time. And I think one of the ways we've been able to resolve, you know, are we ready type questions is we've been able to bring on a partner called Munich Re, which is basically an insurance organization. They did a lot of work with solar in the early days to make those organizations bankable. We brought Munich Re on in 2018, I believe, and did around 18 months of due diligence for them. And in the end, they basically vetted our technology and said, we're going to give you two warranty products. The first one is going to be an investment grade warranty on your technology. Basically, anything that's in the field, they'll back for over 10 years. And the other one's gonna be a project-based warranty, which essentially says, you know, we'll warranty any project that your customer has in the field. And if something happens to ESS while that warranty's in place, we'll basically come in and step in and make sure that project's hold. So that's business continuity insurance, essentially. So with that insurance policy in partnership with Munich Re, it's been able to really make ESS a bankable organization. And really drive these products to the field.
No, critically important to have that support for your customer to give them the reassurance to proceed, as you say, both financially and also with from a technology point of view. One thing that always, going back to my early point of, you know, entrepreneurs and founders come in all shapes and sizes and all kinds of backgrounds, clearly you've got a phenomenally strong technical background. How have you dealt with, and it's an issue that a lot of CEOs, you know, spend an awful lot of time on, and that's the challenge of raising capital to expand. Clearly, you bootstrapped to an extent, but you've taken investment over the years, and it can be a hugely time-consuming process. And right now, I guess there's an awful lot of noise around the sort of clean tech investments from VC, from PE, and of course the kind of SPAC numbers recently have been fairly crazy. How are you managing, and how have you managed growth, and how have you adapted that sort of, I guess, financial string to your bow, having, you know, come from perhaps a more engineering and academic background?
Yeah, so you know, my background is I have an aerospace engineering degree, I have a mechanical engineering degree, and I also have an MBA from Carnegie Mellon. So, you know, I get some business background from that MBA and the work I did with Carnegie Mellon, but you know, I would say that the fundraising aspect has never been the most fun part of this thing. I'm a technical person by heart, and I love to do technical things. But I realized, you can't build a business without money. So you just gotta suck it up, and you know, you put your backpack on and you go fly around the world and you do your 10-minute pitches. And in the early days, that's what I would do. Julia would stay back at the lab and continue to keep the technical stuff going. And
yeah.
I'd get my backpack on and go do 10-minute pitches around the North America, or even in Europe in some cases. And so, you know, we did a lot of 10-minute pitches where you're trying to win $50,000 or $250,000. And in those days, back in 2010 through 2013, that was a tremendous amount of money for us.
Right.
And even with the grant that we got from RPE, you know, that was still limited on what we can use those funds for, so we were still raising money. And so, you know, it quickly became apparent that the only way you're really going to be able to get money is by showing stuff in the field. And
yep.
So we did deployments in the field, we got customer traction. But that is raising money is a huge time sink. We were extremely purposeful on what money we raised. We weren't doing extravagant things in the office. We try to get 1960s furniture, not because we wanted that, but that was the cheapest. The money is supposed to be put towards the technology, not towards decorating the office. If we have to forego salaries for Julie and I, we would do that in order to, you know, make sure that the technology is taken care of and our employees were taken care of. We never missed payroll. We always made sure our employees were taken care of.
Yep.
And, you know, it seems like we were always raising money. As soon as we closed one round, we were getting ready to close the next round, make sure that we hit our valuation points, to keep the valuation going up, make sure we didn't have a down round, and moving on forward. And so I think the challenge we have now is how do you scale the organization when we're in the field. Most of the feedback we get from the customers we're talking to is, when can we get product and how can we get it faster? And so, you know, we just closed our Series C in 2019. We have part of that Series C coming in again this year to help scale the organization further. There's a lot of opportunities out there. We'll be looking to do another fundraising round here in the near future. It'll be relatively substantial. And the majority of that is going to be towards scaling the organization to getting multi-gigawatt hours out of the factory. The facility we're in today, we moved in 2019. It's around 150,000 square feet. We can do around 2 gigawatt hours per year on this facility once we're up and running 100%. I think we can do around 200 megawatt hours per year today. But one of the benefits with our technology is that it's extremely capital efficient to build. It's around 97% more capital efficient than that of lithium ion on the factory side.
Right.
So we can scale the organization with very little money. And the benefit of that is, you know, we can build a facility in North America, take care of North American operations. We can build a facility in Australia for very little money, take care of Australia. Or same in Europe, or same in Asia. And that's extremely challenging to folks like lithium ion, right? You're stuck with a lot of the Asian manufacturing that you have today because they spent 30 years perfecting that technology with those high-speed coating lines. And so it's hard for someone who's not an incumbent to come into the lithium ion space. But we took a different approach, and we're extremely capital efficient, which means we can be a disruptor, and that's what our intention is.
Yeah. Cool. And it's good to see, obviously, already looking at internationalization beyond the US market, which in itself clearly has massive opportunities. Given the breadth of your experience, Craig, I wouldn't mind if you'd just share a few thoughts, because on the podcast recently, I've spoken to sort of founders and CEOs, not just from renewables and mobility and energy storage, but in sort of more diverse areas. We've had Van Miftikoff, CEO of Zero EVS, of fuel cell hydrogen aviation. We've had fuel cells for buildings and the heavy industry. We've had sort of hydrogen electrolyzers recently. I'm kind of towards the electrification of everything, but still remain technology agnostic. You've got experience across those different pieces. Perhaps you can share a little bit of where you see the future of the energy and mobility transitions, and where perhaps some of those alternative technologies have a place, or do you not see them having a place?
So I would say fuel cells always are a close to my heart, because that's really where I started my part of my career, and spent, you know, electrochemistry is where I've always been, besides the early days of Pratt & Whitney. I love fuel cells. I hope one day we can make them work in mass. There's a lot of challenges, at least when I was in fuel cells 10 years ago. Maybe they solved some of those, but from what I see, a lot of those challenges remain the same, right? They're using the same membrane that we were using a decade ago. The flow fields are the same that we're using a decade ago. It's the same bipolar plate material that are being used a decade ago. So there's not been a lot of material advancement in that space. You're still using platinum, right? And the cost is not necessarily driven by platinum, but it's going to be driven by the coating. And so until you get a lot of volume on those coating lines for the fuel cells, it's going to be hard to drive down those costs. And then it's always around the durability. How do you maintain the durability of fuel cells? When I was in the fuel cell days, we'd always say, so if batteries just came out when you're working on fuel cells, would you do a battery or would you do a fuel cell? And everybody would always say, I'd do battery, because at least you didn't have to worry about pumping hydrogen and pumping air and always at the same time. It was already contained. So once you got it charged, it would work. And there was always challenges with fuel cells back in the days. But they're getting better. I think they'd be great for aviation if we can figure out a way to get everything compressed and get the weight down on that stuff. But I think batteries are the next thing for the electrification of the grid. And so you get renewables such as wind, solar, hydro, integrated with things such as batteries, electrochemical batteries, flow batteries. And that's what's going to stabilize the grid. I think lithium ion stuff and fuel cells are fantastic for traction, but long term, flow batteries I think are the appropriate technology for the grid itself.
Yeah. I think that's always come back to one of the costs is the ability to scale. Go back to the point we talked about earlier about scaling just brings so many benefits, not least of which or significantly around cost reduction, which is always important. And it's difficult to scale some technologies, and I sort of revert back to kind of long time before I was in clean tech, hydrogen was always the next big thing, and it still seems to be right on the cusp, but it does seem to be there's some really interesting movement in that more recently, fuel cells that don't require platinum, and as I say, the aviation, fuel cell aviation was really fascinating to see.
It's easier mobility, to move electrons than it is to move hydrogen.
Yeah, exactly. And they do have that advantage of the ability to create and store them or generate and store them relatively easily. But it's interesting to have someone who's got a broader experience across that piece. Craig, it's been really useful and really interesting to talk to you. Before we sort of disappear, I always like to look at and explore some of the places that you've gained inspiration either in your early days or places you go back to for inspiration when times are perhaps a little bit tough. Are there any books or thought leaders or places that you would perhaps point people to that have been instrumental in your journey so far?
That's a great question. I have three young kids, so there's not a lot of book reading that goes on besides Dr. Seuss and things like that. But I would say my early days at United Technology, I think, were instrumental in where I am today. There was a lot of really great engineers at UTC, particularly at the power division. And I learned a lot at Pratt Whitney as well, but the UTC power division back in the day with Mike Perry and Rob Darling and Jeremy Myers, that cohort that I was in, I learned a tremendous amount from them, and I still talk to those folks today. They're scattered around North America now, doing different things. But they are they're a fantastic group of people. Learned a lot from them, would love to do something with them later. But in terms of books, I tend to be a kind of a science nut, and so I love astronomy and aviation. So I tend to focus on those kind of things. I think one of the interesting books that I used to read back in the day when we actually could travel on airplanes, when I'd be going on business trips, was the one book that We Have No Idea, A Guide to the Universe, The Unknown Universe. So that was always an interesting book, basically talking about how we don't know almost anything. And then there's another one for aviation. I kind of go back to, there's a book called Understanding and Maintaining the PA-46, which is an aircraft that I kind of like. Those are the two things that I, when I'm frustrated or whatnot, I'll kind of go focus on those for a little bit.
Go break out. Yeah. No, it's good to be able to do that. You make an interesting point, actually, in terms of traveling. It's tough sometimes to keep up the reading element when you're doing a million and one things. But one thing you could always do on a transatlantic flight or on a longer flight was read. But in the last year, that's, of course, not been something that's been possible.
Yeah. I'm ready for this to be over.
Yeah. Cool. Listen, really appreciate you sharing some insights with us, Craig, and for your time. We will obviously continue to keep a lookout for ESS and your evolution as a business. In the meantime, in the podcast episode notes, we'll obviously point people in the direction of your website and other places where they can find out a little bit more. But thanks very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thank you, David. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Craig and some of the listen to some of the challenges, both commercial and technical, that it takes to overcome to have a successful cleantech business. And yet, of course, the challenges and opportunities just keep coming. Next episode, we're going to be talking all things funding, finance, M&A, and what it takes to scale a cleantech startup with Gerard Reed of Alexa Capital. I hope you join me then.